Today on Backroom Politics
Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, can the royal wedding actually save our debt crisis here in America? Haley Barbour is out, Ron Paul is in, and Donald Trump is going to New Hampshire? Really? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. And there's the opening here. It is 4 o'clock here on the East Coast, probably still 1 o'clock on the West Coast. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. With us, as always, every Tuesday is our usual roundtable of political pundits. He is the former, he's a former 8-term member of Congress from Washington State's 2nd District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington National Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
Good day after Easter, first program after Easter.
First program after Easter, that's correct. Welcome back. I hope, how was your holiday?
It was wonderful.
Good.
It was wonderful.
Good.
The Easter Bunny came and left eggs, and my granddaughter appreciated
that. Oh, that's good. Did you get an Easter basket?
I did not get an Easter basket, and I did not appreciate it.
Oh, that's too bad. We'll take it up with the Easter Bunny. Sitting directly across from me, as he is every Tuesday from this time, he is the former floor chief for then-Congressman Gerald Ford. He's a former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation, former board member of the National Association of Broadcasters. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back. Happy Tuesday.
Thank you, Justin. Hope your Easter was as good as mine.
It was. Very nice time down at Disney. And sitting to my right, as he is every Tuesday from this time, he is the Vice President for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is our international pundit. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back. Happy Tuesday.
Glad to be here, Justin. Hope you had a wonderful Fuha Jie.
If Fuha Jie is Chinese for Easter, I did. Thank you. See, we're learning Mandarin as we speak. Yeah. That's fantastic. Folks, I got to tell you, there's a lot of buzz going around this town. First of all, we're going to start off with the top of the hour about the continuing fiscal crisis that's facing America right now. The debt ceiling is continuing to loom. New numbers are showing that we're basically at 70% of GDP to our debt ratio on that. So that's not a comfortable feeling. This is something that the country has not seen in a long time, if ever. And bottom line is, we've got to make some moves on this. And I will tell you right now, it is getting interesting. Now we've heard Speaker of the House, John Boehner, make some, I guess he has alluded to making some deals that have been coming forward between him and Democratic leaders in the House. Bob, you've had your ear to the ground up there on the Hill. Have you seen anything or heard anything going on?
Just what you said. I know the Speaker has been talking to a lot of people. Not surprisingly, some Democrats on the House side, Democrats in the Senate, the leadership, and the Tea Party people, because he's going to have to encourage a lot of Tea Party people to support some revenue increase one way or another, and that's a hard thing for them to do given the way they campaigned on their election year and a half ago.
Are we close to a deal that's actually feasible in this time frame?
I would say we're not yet close to a deal. I think you can see an outline. I think you can see a variety of issues. But each one, as Boehner said before the deal 2 weeks ago on the budget, there is no deal until all agreements are made.
Right.
So, and I think right now we're in the situation where people are talking about, let's say, the issue of raising taxes, raising revenue. I think the question is, which ones are you raising and by how much?
Well, and
those,
as a, And as always, we always invite our callers, our listeners out there in Radio Land to call in. You can dial in at 619-638-8477. Again, the number is 619-638-8477. Ralph, you've been seeing a lot of maneuvering on the international front. Has any of the deals that they've been working on right now given the international community a little bit more stability in all that's going on?
Well, interesting. Hello, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, we just former mayor of New York, great city of New York City, Mayor Rudy Giuliani.
I was just listening to your excellent analysis.
Thank you very much.
We need to have you come on.
We'd love to have you on the show.
Would you like to make the announcement? I'm back. I've never been interviewed smoking a cigar, so I want to do that.
We do that over cigars every Tuesday from 4 to 6.
Okay, I'll find you on
Mayor Giuliani, thanks for stopping by. That is fantastic. That is great. Ladies and gentlemen, Mayor Rudy Giuliani stopping by the Shelley's Backroom Studio here of Backroom Politics. That was a treat. Did not expect that.
No.
That was awesome.
And we failed to ask him if he was running for president.
No, he tried. We will talk about that here shortly in the next subject. So for those of you listening, that's right. That was Rudy Giuliani, and we'll blog that one. You'll get that one back up. So going back to the original question before the mayor stopped by, has the international community actually kind of stabilized in their fears of what's going on with the debt crisis, with the deals that are looming?
Interestingly enough, Singapore now has become a trading hub for the RMB. The Chinese are doing everything they can to diversify the yuan, the Chinese currency. The Chinese are trying to diversify away from the dollar, and this is really worrying Washington, D.C. So this potential deal that the speaker is putting together is going to be looked at very closely by the Chinese and other countries.
Well, I got to tell you something. We're starting to see the political maneuvering of everybody getting ready to dig in on what could be a possible deal coming from the Hill to the White House. Al, we've talked about this before, and I just want to reiterate the issue is they can come up with all the deals they want, but until they get the message out to the general public, not much is going to change. Are we in a situation right now where they're starting to get that on the Hill? They're starting to come up with some credible messaging to the general electorate?
I don't know whether they have figured it out yet or not, but what surprises me is that their future depends on them doing this. If they have to make some tough votes and they have an electorate that has some understanding of why they did it, they got a chance of being reelected. If they have some tough votes and the electorate thinks that it's just same old crap, they're gone. They're gone. So I think they need to do it very much.
But that's going to mean, in some cases, raising taxes. And how do you bring along the Tea Party people who campaign strictly on
government? I'm saying is if you want to be reelected, you better figure out how to do it.
Well, you know, this brings up a valid point, and I want to go back to the teaser that I gave at the introduction of the show, is how the royal wedding could be a possible solution to our current debt crisis. Now, when I mentioned this as a topic to the roundtable, everybody kind of looked at me like I had two heads. How is Kate and William's marriage going to help solve our debt crisis? Well, the answer is, I've talked about this several times on this particular show in previous weeks. The tough decisions that Prime Minister David Cameron's made out of 10 Downing Street and his austerity measures in a coalition government with the Liberal Democratic Party in the UK, which is far left of the Liberals that have been in power in the Labour Party for years, they've actually come to agreements to make some of these tough decisions in Great Britain to help bring back what was an unstable economic situation in London.
The Brits had reached a point similar to Zimbabwe where their currency was starting to become worthless, and they were at the point of just starting to print money that had no value. And then finally they decided, look, we have to come together, otherwise our whole economy is just going to go down the toilet.
Well, you know, I've got to give credit. Joe Scarborough, in a piece in Politico this week, was talking about David Cameron's situation in London. Joe Scarborough nailed it on the head. I mean, pretty much calling out saying Cameron's political career is done after this government folds under the weight of having to make these tough choices. I mean, looking at the choices that Cameron's made, let's look at them. They're similar to the choices we have to make. He's having to make serious, serious cuts in the National Health Service in Great Britain, which is not unlike the decisions and the cuts we're going to have to make in Medicare and Medicaid. David Cameron's made that decision. Bob, I put this up to you. Is President Obama willing to make those tough decisions, even at the expense of his political career, or is it too early to tell? Bob?
Well, let me put it this way. I haven't seen him say anything as focused on this issue as, let's say, the Republicans in the House have said with respect to some of the entitlements. I've seen him talk about taxes, and I've seen him make statements about cuts, but I haven't seen him do anything that is specific. I think he's going to have to get there. He is the agenda setter, but right now I haven't seen him do it.
Al?
Bob is exactly right. I've been disappointed. I said on this program a couple of months ago that it seemed to me that the best way to solve this problem was for President Obama to announce that he was not going to run again. And then, based upon that demonstration of courage, ask other politicians to come along and make the tough choices and proceed from there. Now, that was a little bit fanciful, but from what you're saying, maybe it's not as fanciful as it seems.
It appears that David Cameron's made that decision already.
Well, you will remember that some time ago, and I don't remember the circumstances, the president, President Obama, did say he'd rather be a successful one-term president than be a two-term president. So, it may be in his mind. I don't know, but I haven't seen it yet.
Right. Ralph?
The interesting thing is when you look at Europe, especially Britain, they're willing to pay higher taxes, but they expect the government to provide for them, to pay for their health insurance, to provide a pension. And now what you're seeing is these Western democracies don't have the money coming in to be able to fund pensions and health insurance and the other benefits that people are expecting that have become accustomed to.
Well, the whole
mindset is having to change.
Well, we're also dealing with an economy where the public debt in Great Britain is at 11.5%
right.
of its total economic output compared to the 10.7% that the U.S. is facing right now. But we've also seen, as a result of some of these austerity measures, exports out of Great Britain are at the highest levels ever. They're seeing an economic renaissance in technology. They're seeing an economic renaissance in financial services based out of London and out of Great Britain. So at some point, somebody's going to have to make a decision. Now, one of the key deciding factors in how successful some of these austerity measures are going to be is going to come on Thursday when the unemployment numbers come out and when the GNP number comes out from Whitehall, the seat of British government. So we're going to see if that's going to be. Now, they had a flat line in unemployment and a slight decrease in GDP fourth quarter of last year. This is going to be the telltale sign of whether these austerity measures are going to be successful. Now, that being the case, does Washington just wait to see what those numbers look like, or do we just make those hard decisions now? Whereas, you know, one of the other things he was talking about cutting back was privatizing a lot of the federal agencies that are in Great Britain. That arguably could be done here.
See, the success of the Asian system is that they don't have this cradle-to-grave support system where people expect to be taken care of by the government. They're creating a free market system where you can create your own business, there are no taxes, and you make your own way in the world. You're not going to be coddled. You're not going to have a support system. And China has had issues because they don't have a Social Security or a Medicare to take care of the elderly.
Well, so
these are very interesting issues that are coming out now.
Well, that raises a good question. Is, you know, with the fight that's been going on regarding Medicare and Medicaid, with the fight that's been going on regarding Social Security, which is basically our social welfare system, are we becoming a country of cradle-to-grave entitlement? Or are we? Do you foresee a time where we'll get back to the free market society that made this country great at one time? Al?
I think you might have argued that that was where we were headed. I don't think we are anymore. I mean, this is by the time we have this resolved, and I assume we will resolve it, and we will have absorbed a lot of pain in the process of solving it, because I don't think there's any other, but there's not a painless way to do it. I think it will put the brakes on hard on any further efforts of cradle to grave. In fact, it'll probably roll some things back. One of the things the president could do, we talked about his activity, is if he hasn't quite yet got the courage to bull in and make specific proposals, I think one speech that said, look, everybody's going to have to give. There will be tax increases in this bill. There will be cuts in social programs dear to the hearts of the liberal. What we have to figure out is how we do that in the way that most benefits or least hurts the American people and the American economy. And I don't know why that would be so hard for him to say.
Bob, you want to tell in on that?
I don't think it should be hard for him to say either. But I think it needs to be said, and it should be said soon. Last week when we were talking about the S&P report, I said then that I was concerned that if we wait until the deadlines on the deficit stuff, if we wait until the very end, by that time, financial markets around the world will have taken action. Whatever they're going to do, they will have probably done some of it. I'd much rather see them get started, you know, as soon as the Easter recess is over. Congress is now at home this week. They get back next week, and if they and the president would get together and start working on these issues in the next couple of weeks, I mean, I think it could be reasonably hoped that by the end of May, we are in a very good situation to say we've got the thing pretty well nailed down.
Well, I think we've got a problem, though. You know, one of the things that we're going to have to deal with is the fact that all this is happening at the Easter recess. Al, as a former member of Congress, you know, when you go back for Easter recess, you go back to the district, obviously you're having town halls throughout the district. You're hearing the voice of the people. They're concerned about what's going to happen in their district, not so much what's going to happen nationwide. Are we going to get into a situation where they're going to come back with an earful from the district and it's going to create an even further stalemate in what we're trying to accomplish here nationally?
Entirely possible. But what you usually hear on these kinds of issues when you go home is a lot of anger, not a lot of direction.
And people are angry about the Medicare because they feel
they're
it's being
privatized.
They're
angry about the Medicare. They're angry about increasing taxes. They're angry about it all. So they don't really send any kind of a message that their congressman can say, well, now I've got a good reading of what the people in my district want. He may come back and say that.
No.
But it's not true. And so these civic temper tantrums that occur often at these kinds of recesses aren't as helpful as they should be. I used to, in situations like this, do fewer of these public finance forums where everybody screams at everybody and do a few where I would call in people of a variety of issues for a discussion. And I was more likely to pick up a sense of where people were going than I ever would standing, and letting people throw tomatoes at me.
Bob, when we see everything, when we see the dust settle from the Easter recess, are we going to see more possible leadership coming out of the Hill, or are we going to see more fractured disparity in not only globally in Congress, but even within, for example, the Republican Party?
I see a willingness to tackle the issues in the Republican Party. I see it in the Gang of Six in the Senate. I see it in other areas of Congress. I think that if the president will step up as the agenda setter and say, okay, guys, we're going to sit down.
Not unlike David Cameron.
Yep, we're going to sit down and we're going to start talking. Everything is on the table, and you have to say everything is on the table.
Including non-discretionary spending.
Exactly. And you said it very well in the moment we started this discussion. It's too bad that the recess comes just when this problem hits public attention, because the members have not had a chance themselves to catch up with as much information as they would like to have when they're back home, so that they could talk in relatively knowledgeable terms. I mean, a lot of people know the general outlines of the problem, but it would have been helpful, I think, if his members went home, both parties had been able to provide their members a lot of facts and figures so that they could be more specific in their conversations with their constituents, because that would help, as Al said, to have good discussions rather than just listening to angry people.
Well, we're coming up on 20 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a quick two-minute break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about the austerity measures in Britain, how they could possibly be mirrored here in the United States. We're going to go through line item by line item, the big third rails that David Cameron's been dealing with. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're still a little stoked here from an earlier visit by Mayor Rudy Giuliani, former presidential candidate in 2008. Truly one of the great, great men out of New York City, truly a great patriot. That was kind of a surprise, but you never know what's going to happen here on Backroom Politics, kids. You got to stay with us.
Stay tuned in, everybody.
Stay tuned. You know, I'll tell you, everybody comes into Shelley's from time to time.
Including Arnold Schwarzenegger on several occasions.
Yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger has been here on several occasions. We invite you to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We're talking about the current debt crisis and the fiscal situation here in the U.S., and we're talking about a piece in Politico which called out something that I've been talking about several times on previous programs about Prime Minister David Cameron and Nick Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister, who formed a coalition government in the UK. They've actually been making some really tough decisions. When we look at what they've touched, when we look at some of the stuff that they've kind of wrapped around. They've talked. We've already talked about the effect on the National Health Service in Great Britain. That's a huge third rail. That mirrors quite closely our Medicare and Medicaid issue. They're talking about laying off thousands of public workers in the UK. Now, that's also a third rail here. The federal government, can our federal government really sustain a layoff of that magnitude, Al?
Well, if you do it selectively, yes. But for example, I don't think there's any Americans who want us to go in and start laying off air traffic controllers at the present time. And what one of the myths that makes this so hard for politicians to handle is the American public believes in the myths that there are all kinds of agencies that are utterly useless, do nothing except spend money. And so their idea is you get rid of all of those and you've got a good start. Well, there aren't many of those, if any. I think there are ones that where you can trim. But there are very few that are sitting around doing nothing that benefits the country.
Bob, can in your view, could we sustain a layoff of that magnitude that they're doing in Great Britain?
Well, remember, we're a little bit different than Great Britain. We have 50 states. We may not be, in a situation where we're going to be laying off hundreds of thousands of federal workers. But if you take a look at what's going on in a number of states today and will be going on in the future, we may discover that the percentage of public employees that got laid off are going to be more in the states than they are in the federal government. And they're still unemployed. They're still looking for work. They're still wondering what to do. So I don't know that we'll. I think from the standpoint of the federal government, our percentage of reductions may be a lot smaller at the federal level than theirs is at their national level. But you put our state workers in the pot too, just as you'd have to, because they don't have states over there. We'll probably have a big number of people unemployed from the state level in the next 18 months.
Well, one of the other, or Ralph, go ahead.
The U.S. has gotten away with having deficits just because the dollar has been tied in with so many other international currencies. I still don't think the American people recognize the seriousness of the situation. If you start to fire all these government employees or state workers, I mean, you're not going to have support. You're not going to be able to get things done. The overwhelming majority of people want the rich to be taxed. That's what it's showing in poll after poll.
Well, let's talk about that, because one of the other items, or before we do that, Al, you want to make a comment?
Just let me throw out an idea. I do not understand why you could not do this. Have all regulations that are specifically targeted at certain kinds of things, clean air, clean water, bank regulation, all of it be paid for by the industries that are regulated. They don't hire them. Federal government hires them, but they get billed for those things.
You're talking about almost like a user fee.
Exactly. Then what I would add to it is that user fee will be set at a level. Okay?
Right.
And the first time you're reviewed, if you get clean health, it stays at that level. And the second time, and the third, and the fourth time. But the first time you find that you're in some violation, your cost goes up.
Along with paying for the penalties.
The cost of paying for the penalties goes up on the argument that we're going to have to pay greater attention to you and you're going to cost us more money. And by that way, you're doing a couple of things. You're getting an awful lot of people off the payroll, essentially. At least they're getting paid. And you're providing an incentive for industry to do what it's supposed to do in the first place.
What about accelerating retirement? For a lot of these people.
Let's talk about that in a second, but I want to go back to Al's point. One of the industries that's actually done something like that is the financial industry created FINRA, the Financial Industry's Regulatory Authority. It's completely voluntary. They pay into it, and they help monitor the compliance with financial regulations. Now, FINRA could we use a FINRA model to take over some of the actions of the SEC? On top of that, could we use that model for clean air, clean water, some of the EPA regulatory functions?
I have often thought that we could do more of that than we do. Industry using its own resources to regulate.
Why don't we do that?
Well, I think because we don't trust industry. I know I don't trust industry. That doesn't mean every single company, I think, is on the take, but it does mean that there are enough examples of where people play fast and loose with the truth.
But, Bob, we've seen that, too.
I mean, we've seen self-regulation in several laws. You know, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 gave self-regulation to the oil companies on how they can respond to oil spills. Some say, as a result of Deepwater Horizon, it wasn't effective. Can we make it effective and do that kind of self-regulation?
Well, you can certainly make it effective if the companies know that if they have a problem, which can be shown that they were not up to par, then they get a good penalty. They get a good penalty, or they get an increase in their regulatory fee, whatever we're talking about.
All right.
But the fact of the matter is, that kind of something is the best kind of regulation. It's the kind of regulation. They know better than any regulator in the government what they need to do in order to be doing the right thing.
But let's talk about that for a second. Now, we talk about the need to bring in foreign companies to come in and base operations here in the U.S.
Right.
Would something like we're talking about scare off foreign industry?
Possibly. It depends how you cultivate these foreign companies when they're here. Because you don't want another situation like with Huawei when they came over here thinking they were going to do business, and they got into a lot of political trouble because of the wrangling among different members of Congress over whether they were a valid Chinese company or something else.
Al, you had a stop in there.
I just think that the secret to this is how do you have an ultimate oversight where you're not just relying on industry to be honest? I think if you have at some point with some frequency, not necessarily every year, but on a rotating basis, you have a thorough accounting.
Right, accountability.
In there. And lay the penalties on them if they're wrong. And if they have been abiding by the rules that they themselves have set up, which have been government approved. I would see that government had approved those. But if they've been abiding by their own rules, they have no additional cost. If they haven't been, then it's going to cost them a lot more money.
Did you support the accounting rules that came into effect after Enron?
I wasn't in Congress at the time, and I wasn't paying that close attention. I happen to have loathed Enron for a variety of other reasons. And so I just assumed it.
Because you have the problem where the regulators are in bed with the people they're supposed to be regulating.
Well, we saw that in the Deepwater Horizon where the folks over at Interior were arguably in bed. The folks at
Minerals
at MMS, Minerals Management Service.
And we've seen that in the Department of Agriculture. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that does happen. So if we could get the people that are doing the day-to-day, the month-to-month, the year-to-year supervision of the regulation to be the industry itself, according to a set of regulations approved by the government, and then once in a while, and probably not on a predictable basis, you send some people in who they have not been having dinner with for weeks, and whom they do not know on a personal basis, and they have not been playing gin rummy with, and they do a thorough exam, and I think that might just scare enough people in.
Let me ask this question, though, Bob. You know, from the Republican side, that sounds like, to me, we're creating a bunch of unfunded mandates. Up the fund type of regulatory model.
Well, first of all, if they're setting the regulations,
industry, not Congress.
If they're setting the regulations, there's going to be the tension as they get set up between as easy as you can and tough enough to be useful. Once that's settled and the regulations are in place and they are responsible for the monitoring of the regulations, and if they don't meet that monitoring criteria, they're in deep doo-doo. Once that's set up, I think it's a pretty good idea. I think Republicans would not have a problem with regulations that are initially created by the industries, approved by the government, overseen by the industries, and only get in trouble when they don't meet the standards. That's self-regulation. That is entrepreneurs doing the job they're doing. One of the jobs they want to do is keep out of the trouble of the government and don't do bad things. And if it costs a little money, it's cheaper for them to do it that way than it is to get caught by the government and penalized.
But one other thing, and for the Democrats to ever go along with this, you would still have to have this occasional audit.
Yeah.
That's the word I was looking
right.
for. By an independent government agency to just keep everything on the up and up.
It depends how independent it's going to be, because a lot of these accounting firms had what they called independent auditors, but they were really in bed with the people they were supposed to be auditing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was no oversight.
Yeah.
And that's when you had companies like Enron collapsing, and it destroyed the whole accounting industry.
That's the problem. That's the biggest problem that something like this would engender in a lot of people, particularly, I think, in Democrats, who would say, can you trust people to be self-regulators, even if the government is oversighting them?
Well, you're putting
look at the past.
You're putting a lot of faith in industry to, quote-unquote, do the right thing.
That's right. Right.
And if you were, from a Democratic point of view, the Democrats on the Hill would argue that we've tried that and it's failed miserably, i.e., Enron, i.e., Deepwater Horizon.
And they expect the government to come in and bail them out, which has been another big issue. Because why should they be bailed out when a small business, if they go under, no one's going to help them?
If the penalties are severe enough, the CEO is going to have that in the back of his mind on a continuing basis. It's one thing to have a problem. It's something else to get fined and seriously damaged at the bottom line.
But where is the balance? What I'm hearing is a great idea, but where is the balance between drawing in and having companies start holding their operational control here in the United States from overseas, having to come into an environment of self-regulatory and having to pay for that regulatory oversight?
You're going to have to create a favorable tax rate for them to be able to bring all of their profits offshore into the U.S. You're going to have to make them feel comfortable with working with the regulators and in the regular course of business. But you can, at the same time, allow them to be in bed with the regulators.
But, Alan, am I hearing a catch-22 in that argument?
Well,
where we have to raise revenue by either stopping the loopholes and the tax breaks, excuse me, we're having to look at possibly raising taxes, which isn't going to make a lot of foreign companies bring their investments here to the U.S., but we're also trying to create a favorable regulatory market, which is going to have a fee associated with that. It sounds like there's a catch-22 in there.
No matter what you do, you're going to have something akin to a catch-22. I am told, and I don't know a great deal about this, but in Europe, when a law is passed and the regulations have to be written, the industry will fight the law tooth and toenail, but if it passes, then they get involved in writing the regulations because, as you noted earlier, they have the expertise. The government bureaucrats often have theoretical knowledge and have legalistic knowledge that is useful, but they don't have they don't know which way you screw the nut on the boat. So if it can be done there, maybe it can be done here. My first suggestion is, if the idea had any merit at all, let's start small and bring in a regulated industry, their union, the regulators that we have here, if appropriate, the environmentalists or other public interest groups, and sit down and say, can you work one out and see what it looks like?
You know, that these are some great ideas that I think need to go to the Hill, but it doesn't sound like the Hill's up for listening to any quote-unquote great ideas right now. They've got it set in their mind. They have a certain outline that they need to work with. Is that accurate?
The Hill never listens to ideas. The Hill is an action place. It simply, occasionally someone will hold thoughtful hearings. And sometimes hearings can be just tremendous, but not usually. And that's the reason that I think establishing little independent commissions to do the thinking for you, to get there.
You have a lot of posturing.
My predecessor walked into my office 3 months after I'd been elected, and he'd served for 14 years in the Congress. And I said, "How you doing after 3 months?" And he says, "I'm doing wonderful. I've even had some time to think." The life of a member of Congress does not lead itself to be thoughtful and do the inquisitive kinds of things.
CEOs that are making. Bill Gates says the same thing.
You know, Warren and I have been talking about this a lot.
Yeah.
I'll bring him on the show.
I had a guy back home who ran a very successful company making a special kind of wood product, and he was wealthy. And he'd been born wealthy. And he was very, very conservative politically. He and I got along for reasons I'm not sure why, but I liked him a lot. He said, why should I be even receiving Social Security?
There should be an option for
said,
people to opt out.
This is pocket change for me. And why should I be receiving? So he was talking basically about means testing Social Security.
Yeah.
Well, I immediately objected to that on philosophical grounds.
Why?
On philosophical grounds, that it was originally set up as an insurance program, and as a right, not a welfare program. I have since, well, I had to swallow hard and vote for the commission several years ago that saved Social Security that began to start
means testing.
So. You can't be half a whore. You know, I'm in it for that. We might as well go the whole way. But the idea that the $6,000-$7,000 a month max that somebody in his bracket might get when he's earning $400,000 or $500,000 a year, it makes no sense at all.
Well, when we talk about means testing, we're talking about Social Security reform. Now, anytime somebody says Social Security reform, everybody's ears just light up and everybody starts going, whoa, time out.
But what about raising the retirement age? Because
well, that's another issue. I mean, you're talking.
And it's going to be the left. It's going to be my party that is going to raise the most hell about that. So what we're faced is the Republican Party being, in my judgment, wholly irresponsible with regard to adding revenues. And the Democratic Party being wholly irresponsible in terms of its refusal to even examine reductions in spending.
And so you wonder why nothing gets done, because on both sides of the problem, there's a party that refuses to do what needs to be done.
But here's the point. No, but here's the point, though. You know, when you talk about Social Security, AARP, one of the largest special interest groups in town, just starts jumping up and down.
Sure they do.
When you start talking about, you know, raising the retirement age, AARP starts screaming. When you start talking about raising corporate taxes and tax on the wealthy, the folks over at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce start firing up.
Yeah, but look. When the Social Security was implemented, one, the life expectancy was a lot shorter.
Yeah. Right.
And that needs to really be pushed. People
Second,
understand that.
Yes, and secondly, the amount of money involved was much, much less. And there's a third point that I will think of at some point.
There were a whole lot more people who were working. There were like 10 workers for every one, you know, annuitant.
In 1932, when they created the Social Security Act. Okay.
Now we're down to, in fact, 2.5 people working for one person getting Social Security.
Now,
and I remembered my other point.
Okay.
And that is, and older people were a lot poorer in general across the board then than they are today. And I remember an AARP meeting held in my district in which... The people were really upset about all the things you just mentioned, that Congress was looking at this and looking at that. And after it's all over, a group gathered around me who had been complaining about, you know, the fixed income and da-da-da-da-da-da. And their basic message was, don't you let the Ways and Means Committee start messing around with taxes on my oil stocks.
You can't have it both ways, folks.
Well,
you can't have it both ways.
If you're rich enough to have oil stocks, I have a hard time dealing with your crocodile tears over the other stuff. So the original idea was that I remember my grandparents, all four of them, they lived on pennies, and Social Security saved their dignity
in earlier
years.
Well, that's what it was designed for.
Since that time, we've become a much more wealthy country, generally, and we're back to means testing, aren't we?
And Roosevelt said it was just a kind of supplement. It was not something people were supposed to rely on.
Well, we do get back to means testing, but when we get back to means testing, again, you're going, and we're going to have to come up with some decisions, some very tough decisions that's not going to make everybody happy. We have to realize that. And that is something that in the vacuum here in Washington, not everybody gets, Bob. Nobody's really taken a look at saying, hey, I'm not going to make 100% of my constituency thrilled over some of these tough decisions. Nobody's taken personal accountability in this. Is that a bad assessment, Bob?
Well, listen, everybody on Capitol Hill knows exactly what they don't want to do. They don't want to touch Social Security.
Well, they don't want to get unelected. They don't want to get unelected.
And that's the way you get unelected, unless you all join hands and jump off the cliff together, and we haven't gotten there yet.
Al.
In a Democratic caucus, I once heard a gentleman, a well-known member of Congress, stand up and say to Speaker Jim Wright, he said, but Jim, you can't raise taxes. We'll all lose the next election. And Jim, who had a short temper, flushed bright red and stood up and pointed at him and he said, did you come here to govern or did you come here to get reelected?
That's a very valid question.
That is precisely the question that should be asked every single member of the Congress.
Well, you know what? That's not a bad idea. Now, the question comes up is, when it comes to governance, when it comes to governing, these tough decisions have to be made.
Well, and several of the Democratic legislators did it on health care and were defeated.
It cost a friend of mine, she was a one-term member of Congress, served 2 years in Congress, and was unelected because she voted for Obama health care in a largely Republican district. But she made that tough decision.
And she served a useful purpose in the 2 years she had.
Arguably she did. Arguably she did.
She could have done the otherwise and served more terms and been useless.
I would say
that when we look at all the issues that are out there, and we're coming up on the top of the hour, and we're going to blow through the top of the hour break. When we look at all the issues that are out there, we talk about Social Security. We also have to look at the idea of something that David Cameron's done in Great Britain and Nick Clegg as his deputy in the coalition government. That is actually moving forward and upping the retirement age, which has gotten protests in Greece, Ireland. It's created havoc in Portugal. You know, can we as a country afford to increase the retirement age and not have people lining the streets of Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, the problem in Europe is the birth rate is so low, so you don't have many people that are coming up through the system that are paying into it. The only people that, and then you have a large immigrant population, but they can't find jobs. So what's happening now is there are not enough people in Western Europe that are putting into the system.
Now
they're going to have to raise
it. Al, the only way we have a prayer of getting a package in the general nature that we're talking about is if we can demonstrate that it is balanced. And that means that we're not going to raise taxes as much as Democrats would like to. It means we're not going to cut social programs as much as Republicans would like to. But every time we pick out the rich for a tax increase, we better pick out some social program that we cut back a little bit too, so that when you're talking to people, you can point out that this is a balanced program.
By the way, that's Al's phone going off. You want to answer that, Al? Because we can.
Could be the $1 million client.
It's the thing reminding me that I'm supposed to drink some water.
Oh, okay.
So, excuse me while I take a
sip
of my martini. The point is that if we take these things all separately and talk about all the problems of raising taxes and all the problems of cutting programs in separately, we're going to overlook the fact that this is going to have to be trade-offs. It is not going to be perfect. from anybody's point of view, but if you can point out it is at least reasonably fair, you've got an outside chance of getting something done.
Well, it's top of the hour here in the nation. Actually, it's top of the hour everywhere, but this is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. Joining us as they are every Tuesday from 4 to 6, Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We're talking about the fiscal crisis, not only here in the U.S., but the similar fiscal crisis that they're facing in Great Britain and some of the tough choices that have been made in the austerity measures coming out of 10 Downing Street. One of the other items that David Cameron and Nick Clegg's coalition government talked about was making the tough choice of not only raising the retirement age, but also looking at looking at the unpopular idea of privatizing or deregulating industry, rather. If they deregulate industry, now that goes back to a topic we talked about earlier in the show about coming up with self-regulation. Does that tie into deregulating industry as a whole? Could we make that? Could we connect those dots?
I'm not sure which dots you're trying to connect. I will say this. I do not believe that in a free enterprise system you can have an unregulated economy. The very nature, the magic, if you will, of the free enterprise system is competition. And it just takes one crook in an industry to start a downward spiral of robbing the public. So you have to have some cop there, as much for the advantage of all the honest businesses, which are most of them, to protect them from the dishonest, from the Enrons.
I'd like to step back for just a minute with respect to this. We're talking a lot about what the British are doing. We haven't talked about it, but I think it's next week. There's a vote in Great Britain that would, if it passes, would restructure the way the elections of Parliament are held.
Correct. Right. Correct. It's a voter reform bill.
Yes.
Voter reform legislation.
The reason there is a coalition government is because the Tories agreed to the Liberal Democrats' request. If they join the coalition, they get this vote to vote.
Correct.
So here we are now.
Are they supporting it? Are the Conservatives supporting it?
No, the Liberal Democrats are pushing it, but the Tories are not helping. The Conservatives are not supporting it.
They just promised them that they would have the vote.
That's right. Now,
but they don't support it.
They don't support it. Now, I don't think it's going to win. I don't think there's enough support for it in Great Britain, and particularly I don't think either of the major parties are particularly hot about it, so I don't think it's going to win. Now, I think that could very well destroy the coalition, and all this we're talking about with Great Britain could disintegrate, because I think, quite frankly, you then probably have to have another election.
Well, I mean, that brings up a very, very strong point, and it's something that us here in the United States don't have to deal with, because they are ruled under a parliamentary system versus our tricameral legislative process here.
If the parliament, if the majority party loses the vote, the government ends.
So the government ends.
The unions are very strong in Britain.
Yeah, well, you know, so when we look at that difference, in British governance and U.S. governments, understandably, however, we saw it with Margaret Thatcher, as Joe Scarborough pointed out in his guest column on Politico this morning. Margaret Thatcher did it in 79 and 80. That helped spark some of the fiscal reforms that came as part of the Reagan Revolution. I don't think, and Joe Scarborough points this out again, that David Cameron's going to see the same support. The difference between David Cameron and Margaret Thatcher is Margaret Thatcher did not have a coalition government. It was all Tory. You now have a situation where you have two opposite ends of the spectrum, and Liberal Democrats, the far left, the Tories, the far right, the Conservative Party, they're having to make some decisions. But you have to give Nick Clegg credit. Nick Clegg, now, he's also looking for a way out of this deal, but Nick Clegg has stood up and said, look, these are some of the tough decisions. In order to keep Great Britain solvent and top priority on the world stage, we have to make tough choices. That is a message that is clear and concise coming out of Whitehall. It is not something that's clear and concise coming out of Washington, D.C.
And don't forget, London next year is hosting the 2012 Olympics, and there's been a lot of criticism about how they're going to be able to fund the Games. And that's something that is not coming out in the press, but it's certainly something.
Sell the crown jewels.
There's this whole issue about lottery funding. How are the athletes going to be supported? How are the venue construction?
One other thing we shouldn't forget. Maggie Thatcher had her biggest successes, and she had many after she won the Falkland War. She whipped the Argentinians, who said, "We're taking the Falkland Islands away," and she didn't give a damn for them, but she wasn't going to lose them.
Right.
And she beat the crap out of them, pardon my French.
Right.
And that made her the most popular
Prime
Minister since Churchill.
So she was able to get.
She was able
other
to. The public was
won.
With her.
Right.
Your French is better than other languages you used in
yes.
That's true. The bar of soap sitting directly in front of Bob Hines.
And it will drop down in front of me if I'm not careful.
It's like the duck on Groucho Marx's show.
Absolutely.
Right. It's a magic word. So
plus there was also the IRA bombing, too, that time.
Well, but regardless, Maggie Thatcher did what she did because Great Britain at that time was facing a truly strenuous fiscal crisis in Great Britain. She made those tough decisions. Now, granted, she did have the benefit of the Falklands War. She did have the benefits of taking a strong arm to the IRA. Good or bad or indifferent, she was able...
Well, we've got three wars. Why isn't it working for us?
Well, we're not winning.
We're not winning.
Oh, I see.
So, when we talk about... you're talking about a war that lasted, 6 months tops?
Yeah.
Versus...
And it took her 2 months to get a fleet down there.
Yeah, exactly. But
she froze the assets of the Argentine.
Thank you.
and that is Haley Barbour. The governor of Mississippi has announced officially that he will not seek the nomination of the Republican Party for president. Now, I got to tell you something. Haley Barbour had some momentum going. His name pops up as one of the top three or four possible candidates that could give Barack Obama a run for his money. I got to say, that could be a good thing, particularly with the history that Haley Barbour has with the RNC. Does this bring up the question? Does Reince Priebus become the quickest chairman, and then all of a sudden we see Haley Barbour sliding into that for a 2012 election cycle?
No.
Behind the scenes.
I think Haley Barbour is one of the most able politicians in America.
Absolutely.
He's extremely bright. He is what I would call a very centrist Republican. And I think, you know, he's conservative, but he's not so far right you can't see him without a telescope.
Well, he's been known to cozy up to the far right as needed, which makes him a very astute politician, but does not bode well for compromise or raising money for an electoral campaign.
And that may be why he's pulled out.
And he's got some racial trouble.
They've been trying to link him to that.
I have no idea whether it's true. I happen to have a lot of respect for him. Don't agree with him on anything. But everything Bob said about him, I agree with. I would add, he was also an extremely effective governor. He knows how to get things
absolutely
done.
And he was an extremely effective chairman of both the National Committee and the Republican Governor.
Let me jump on that, because that brings up a very valid point is, right now, I mean, Reince Priebus becomes the chairman of the RNC, and everybody kind of goes, huh? With Reince Priebus in, and let's be real, Reince Priebus can raise a lot of money when needed, when push comes to shove.
He's proved that.
He has proved it in traditionally liberal districts in Wisconsin, effectively. But do we need, and I say we, being a Republican myself, do we need that kind of leadership from a Haley Barbour? Are we missing that with Reince Priebus?
We're not going to miss that, because Haley is
going to be there.
He is. Is he still the chairman of the Republican Governors Association?
Yes.
I think so. Well, listen, I'll tell you this. He'll be raising money hand over fist, both for the gubernatorial candidates and everybody else. He'll be doing a hell of a job. He'll raise an awful lot of money because people respect him and want to work with him. And he's got friends. He's probably got as good a Rolodex as anybody in the country.
And he's supposed to be mentoring and training Reince Priebus.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. Al?
Well, I was going to save this for tell me the story. I think there's a very good chance that the reason he's pulled out is he's taken a look at the mess that the Republican Party is in and this strange group of people that are running, and he figures 2012 is not possible.
Well, that brings up a valid point. Is now, you know, right now that the current ticket as it stands includes Tim Pawlenty, includes Mitt Romney, it includes
Newt Gingrich.
It now includes Ron Paul. And then we have some of the outsiders that have not yet announced that they're forming the exploratory committee or anything. That includes Michelle Bachmann. That includes
Sarah Palin.
That includes
Mike Huckabee.
Mitch Daniels. Mike Huckabee has alluded to the fact that he probably will not run.
He's not going to say it, but I wouldn't
bet on him running for president. But he's still got to be included. Al, as a Democrat, which one of that lineup gives you the most heartburn for a second term for Barack Obama?
You didn't mention the King of New York, and I don't refer to our guest earlier in the day, but Donald Trump.
Well, we'll talk about him too. Donald Trump is also going up to New Hampshire tomorrow. The details, which ironic, the details of his trip to New Hampshire have been sealed for quote unquote security purposes.
Well, if his hair falls down, he'll cover up the state. So
That wasn't very civil, Al. That was not very civil. Not very First Congress of you, sir.
I just thought of it architectural.
Oh, there we go. Oh, okay, here we go.
It was accurate.
I mean, that brings. I mean, that does bring up, you know, a good point is Donald Trump in the loop. Now, you had said earlier, Ralph, that you thought that Donald Trump could pull a Ross Perot quicker than somebody like a Ron Paul, which, I say what you will about Ron Paul. Ron Paul has always made a name for himself. He's always done these presidential campaigns where he hasn't had a lot of success, but he's always, in the end, done well by the party. He's always done what's always in the best interest of the party.
He's a serious politician with a very set viewpoint, which he feels is a very important viewpoint. It needs to be expressed, and he gets it done.
He does get it done. Yeah.
And I think if you're going to run a third party, you also have to be a very dynamic, maybe it helps to be a little odd, but you've got to have some charisma. And
yeah,
Ross Perot had almost the opposite charisma of Donald Trump, but they both have charisma.
Yeah.
And the
reason you need charisma, and Al's exactly right, is because you don't have an organization around the country that you can call on. You have to be
an organization. Ron Paul is not particularly charismatic. He is loved. He is by the far right. I agree with you that he's serious and all the rest, but he's not charismatic.
No, not at all.
Well, now, again, I go back to when we look at Donald Trump, Ron Paul, Pawlenty, Mitt Romney, when we look at that lineup, who gives you the biggest heartburn for a possible reelection in 2012 for Barack Obama?
Huckabee.
Really? Why?
Huckabee. I don't think he's going to run, but he scared me more the last time because he is a conservative without sharp edges. He is humorous. He is gentle in explaining his views. He doesn't rant. He doesn't scare people like so many people who are as conservative as he tend to do. And he's learned the soft answer turns away wrath and all the rest. And I think that you'd have gentleman versus gentleman in a race, and I think that's probably the worst place that Obama can be, because at this point it doesn't look like he's going to have a hell of a lot of record. He needs to run against somebody who will scare people, and Huckabee isn't going to scare a soul.
Mitt Romney does. You think Mitt Romney has capability of scaring people?
I think Mitt Romney's weaknesses are already apparent.
Right.
And it's not that they scare people, but they don't. But many people don't trust him. He has. He ran to the left of Teddy Kennedy in Massachusetts.
You're saying, and he switched his position on abortion.
Then he became a moderate liberal governor, passed a Medicaid bill or a medical bill that now the right hates, in which he is running away from. I think he has a lot of problems that have been built up over the years that are going to cause him a lot of problems.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Bob. You know, a lot of people come out and theorize the reasoning behind the waffling of Mitt Romney. And the argument I've heard has been that Mitt Romney made the quote-unquote dynamic policy changes that he did in his presidential run versus his run for governor as a Republican in Massachusetts because of the influence of the far right in the RNC. Is there sustainability to that argument?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I don't have any idea how much that influenced. I don't know whether he changed his mind after seeing how it worked in Massachusetts or something else changed his mind. I have no way of knowing.
That's a very reasonable answer. Let me give you a slightly less reasonable answer. That is, given where the Republican Party was going, I think had he not changed, he was out of it. And so he was, in a sense, forced to make the switch for that reason.
Well, then now in today's political environment, do we need a moderate like a Governor Romney Do we need a more moderate? Now, you'd mentioned earlier.
My answer is yes. And if he hadn't switched,
he may be president.
He would be the one that I would most worry about.
Well,
he's incredibly capable.
Yeah.
He's very intelligent. He did a good run as governor in Massachusetts.
And
he saved the Olympics in Utah.
He's been a successful businessman. He's got a whole lot of he's married to the same woman and has a big family. He's got all the kinds of things that you say this is an all-American guy.
Right.
And I may be naive about this, but I cannot believe that his religion is going to be a major problem.
I hope you're right.
I hope you're right. I really do. If people are not going to vote for somebody with the qualifications, no question, Mitt Romney has qualifications to be president.
Yeah.
He's demonstrated that in his years of service.
Well, there's two things he's done that I think qualify him highly. Number one, he was a governor.
Right.
And you have to make decisions.
Which he made some very tough decisions in Massachusetts.
You know, our current president, has only served in the Congress for 2 years when he started running, and he was running for senator. He makes the only decision he makes is, who does he talk to?
Arguably.
I'm being critical. I'm saying that he doesn't have any executive experience. Romney has run a business. He's run a state.
Several.
He's run a major state government, and he's run the United States Winter Olympics. So he's run a lot of things, and he's done well at every one of them.
Right. So this begs the question. Can Mitt Romney overcome the mistakes of 2008 to put a viable campaign together in 2012, or is that ship sailed?
My view is, the ship has certainly sailed with me. But whether it's sailed with everybody else, I don't know. It will be used against him big time by the Democrats. How much it'll hurt him remains to be seen.
Ralph?
I think if the unemployment rate continues to rise, if gas prices continue to go up, people are going to vote their pocketbook, and they will likely want to support Romney because of his fiscal policy.
Bob?
I don't have, my view is that the first primary is still 10 months away. It's so damn early, pardon my French, that it's very hard to find, a reason to pick anyone out and say this guy or this gal is the leader. I don't see it. I don't think that Republicans have anybody. There must be three or four people, I believe, who have a reasonable shot at being the nominee. It depends on how well they organize in about three or four early states. If they do well, I think, it could be any one of three or four people. It's so early.
Two hoops he's got to jump through.
This is Mitt Romney you're talking about.
This is Mitt Romney. Right. He's got two hoops. The first hoop is his health care program, which the Republicans don't like.
Right.
So he's got to come up with a way of explaining that in order to get the nomination. Then whether that continues to be an issue or not is less likely. Then he's got the problem of flip-flop. So I think he's got... he could do it, but it's going to be tough.
It's going to have to come down to economics.
I think I know what he's likely to say about the health care bill, which is, look, I thought that was the best way to do it. It turns out it's more expensive than what we were doing. So if Obamacare is modeled on what I did, it's going to be worse than what we already had, and I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, the argument that can
be an answer.
The argument, the answer I would suggest if I was advising him is saying, look, as governor of Massachusetts, I had to do what was in the best interest of the constituents of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I did that. I did what the public in Massachusetts wanted and needed at that time, and I governed. Al, you're going to give in a wince at that argument.
I'm just saying that neither of these defenses, I think, is ironclad at all.
No, I don't think so. Nothing is ironclad.
And I think you could try them. Democrats have remarkable ability to pull defeat out of the jaws of victory, and they might let him get away with it. But... they should.
From your mouth to God's ears.
They're both are too easy to attack.
Right. Well, let me ask this question then. this begs the question of Donald Trump. Donald Trump has said some pretty ludicrous things over the past 2 weeks, including Obama is quote-unquote, and I want to get this quote right, because this, folks, if this is not a reason to reinvestigate your support of a Donald Trump presidency, I don't know what is. And I'm going to our friends over at Politico for this. Where is that? Bear with me for a second. Donald Trump said that President Obama is, quote-unquote, too dumb for the Ivies. How do you really think...
Too dumb for what?
The Ivies. Going to Harvard for Ivy League. At what time do you sit there and go, wait a minute, that is the type of venom and hatred that we, you know, he jumped on the birther bandwagon, he was confronted on that, and he can't give a straight answer. We have to talk about him. Bob is absolutely coming out of his chair right now. If you could see him,
I don't think any one of the four of us are qualified for the Ivy.
No,
and that would be a good thing.
I went to Georgetown.
That's not an Ivy League. Although Georgetown is a fine institution,
It's better than the five colleges I attended.
How did Central Washington College of Education work into all this?
I'll make a serious point now.
We haven't.
Not right now.
What are you doing to us?
I'm quiet.
Trump has really been going after China, bashing them on many issues. He made a lot of his money in China doing real estate speculation, to the point now that the Chinese have banned any kind of real estate development, with certain exceptions, when it's involving a certain sector like tourism and leisure development. And what Trump has done is really hurt the ability of Americans who want to get into China to do business through his actions over there.
But here's what scares me as a Republican is
he doesn't want anyone else to go into China.
When you see somebody like Reverend Graham supporting Donald Trump and his father being the right reverend to many presidents, when you see Reverend Graham talking about Trump as a legitimate candidate, a lot of people listen to that side of the house. That gives him legitimacy as a candidate for president. At what point do we sit there and say, wait a minute, we've got to circle the wagons and go, look, now's the time as a party. Now, the Democrats, you guys are easy. The Democratic Party's got it easy. You have the White House. It's yours to lose.
We had our time in the barrel before.
True, but right now the White House is yours to lose.
Right.
What we have to do as Republicans, we have to sit around, gather up all the pieces, and look and say, okay, what's viable? What is detracting from us? What I see in the Trump campaign is more celebrity, soapbox. I don't want to say Huey Long, because Huey Long was a viable politician. Donald Trump is a showman.
Well, he's more than a showman. He's obviously a pretty good businessman.
He's only gone broke two or three times,
yeah, but he keeps coming back, which tells
someone
you
someone has bailed him out.
Yeah, but somebody bails him out because they see he can make money for them. The fact of the matter
is... Well, then what's the change? I mean, China's bailing us out now.
He went in and basically raped China by engaging in real estate speculation and hurt their economy.
I can't believe it.
And now he...
A man loved by all.
Yeah. Hey, that's a plus. I hadn't known that.
That is interesting.
But the fact of the matter is, he's had several bankruptcies. He's got three or four wives. You know, he's just immoral. I'm not jealous. Yeah. He's kind of an oddball guy. Now, is he going to get some people thinking he's interesting because of what he says? Yes, but it's a different thing between that kind of willingness to watch him work and seriously consider him for the nomination for presidency for a major American party.
Let's be real. I mean, like it or not, the media is going to be the litmus test. And the media has a way of just, you know, filtering out these type of candidacies. Al is a former member of the media, former Emmy Award-winning broadcaster. Does Trump survive a media inquiry like we're used to seeing in current political circles?
The typical media reaction will be to ride that horse as far as they can get it and build him up as and then dump him.
Really?
Well, they do it all the time.
That's exactly right.
So you think that the media will give this man credibility, make him announce for president,
and they'll egg him on.
You think that he's getting all the media hype because
he says things that are interesting.
Yeah, and he's a celebrity, and he's all of those things. But
and he's connecting with the birther people.
That means that I become more jaded than I ever thought I could be about the media.
Oh well, I guess I can't get more jaded.
I know that I can't.
Good Lord. I got to tell you something, folks. That's just disturbing. We're going to take a two-minute break. It's 15 minutes to the top of the hour. We're coming into the home stretch here of Backroom Politics. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to tell us a story, and we're going to talk about breaking in media circles, which, you know what? I like her. I do. But we'll talk about that in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. On Blog Talk Radio.
I would.
East of the sun and west of the moon. We'll build a dream house of love, dear, near to the sun in the day and near to the moon.
Of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. The last couple of minutes, I want to take a different track here. Normally we just kind of go freeform, but we was talking with Bob Hines, and Bob, you're going to be attending a ceremony next week in the Rotunda next Tuesday, I believe.
Yes.
That I think needs to be mentioned. Bob, tell us a little bit about that ceremony.
Well, Justin, next Tuesday at 11 o'clock, a statue of former President Gerald Ford is going to be installed in the Rotunda. along with people like the President Washington, President Lincoln, President Jackson, some of the greatest presidents of the United States. He's going to be honored there as a member of the Congress, a member of the House, who served there for many years, over two decades, and was later President of the United States. And I had the honor to work for him for a number of years, and it's going to be something that I'm so honored to be able to be there. And it's, he only served 2.5 years after Nixon was forced to resign, appropriately, I might add. And Ford, who never sought the presidency, his highest goal, he wanted to be Speaker of the House, just like his great friend Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House.
Right.
But the Republicans never had the majority when he was in the House. And he went to the presidency, and I think he did a very good job. But most people who have looked at his record think he did, in a relatively short time, some rather significant things. The work he did at Helsinki, at Vladivostok with Brezhnev, led to the Helsinki Accords, which fundamentally, as much as anything else, undermined the Soviet Union's empire in Eastern Europe.
Right.
He was just a good man with a good family. He worked very hard to be a president, and when he retired, I think he did a very nice job of teaching and talking to the University of Michigan students year after year, just helping them understand what the American government was all about.
And Al?
And he was a man of enormous courage. We've been talking about what it takes to do the right thing that's politically unpopular. Now, I bow to no one for my hatred of Richard Nixon. But pardoning Richard Nixon was absolutely the right thing to do.
Right.
And the idea of putting a former president on trial and taking the whole country through all of that would have been a disaster. And I think he knew when he did it that it was going to cause him a lot of problems.
Right.
But yes, he did.
But he did it anyway because it was the right thing to do for this country.
Well, I want to jump in and say that, for those who don't know, I'm a member of the Freemasons, the fraternity. I'm truly honored to call Gerald Ford, President Ford, my brother. I agree with everything that you said, and he was president. I was a child when he was president, but I was, cognizant enough about politics. That was when the bug started biting me, and remembering a lot of the tough decisions he had to make through a time when America really wasn't at its highest level of confidence in Washington. His support for organizations like the Boy Scouts of America, truly, truly admirable. And as a husband, to be there at the side of Betty Ford through her trials and tribulations, through some of the demons that she had to fight, a truly, truly remarkable, remarkable human being that I hope and I'm optimistic that when the annals of history are rewritten, we will see the greatness of Gerald Ford as a true statesman, as truly one of the great statesmen of our time, versus just the finishing up of a term as president. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would. You mentioned his wife. He was the first president to actively be aggressive on the Equal Rights Amendment.
Correct.
And he was a vigorous supporter of Betty and the whole equal rights policy.
Well,
he
and
took a very
great people, Betty in her own right, recovering and moving ahead.
The Betty Ford Clinic.
Betty Ford Clinic
was,
still
lives
exists.
Have been saved.
The Maya Gwaes incident, where we had the Chinese, attack an American ship and take it. He moved very quickly to, get the American prisoners taken by the Chinese freed. He was willing to take military action there. He was the kind of a person who was a very much a man of his own times and place. The Midwest, the heartland of the country, and that's where he's from. He was a All-American football player.
Yep.
He was an Eagle Scout, and he was just one of the nicest and most gentle men I have ever known, who had a streak of iron in his back.
You know, one of the things I always remember, you know, President Ford, Brother Ford, he passed away after Ronald Reagan, and, you know, I remember the turnout. I mean, Reagan was, you know, some call him America's president, and the turnout for his services here in Washington was truly amazing. But I always remember the grace and the honor that his procession through Washington, stopping in front of the World War II Memorial, which...
You're talking about Mr. Ford.
About President Ford.
Yeah.
President Ford's
exactly.
procession through Washington, D.C. It didn't have the popular turnout that we did for President Reagan, but to watch the procession, which I did, both on TV and then living here in D.C., I was able to see it travel through D.C., to watch the grace and just the greatness that was demonstrated by his last tour through Washington, stopping in front of the World War II Memorial, was truly inspiring. It was actually emotional to me. I actually teared up watching that, and just seeing all that. I think that was a testament to the under the radar greatness that Gerald Ford had, and I don't think that word gets out a lot.
That under the radar.